my back. Clearly, he wanted me away from the rest of the humans. So I followed Natasha to my office and saw the sharp way Julian stared at her for a moment before relaxing just enough to be noticeable. Natasha held the office door for me, then closed it behind me, isolating us from whatever was going on in the hall.
I hadn't intended to be in your office without your consent, Natasha said. But when the Crow Guard reported that the humans were acting sneaky and scratching at the doors to places where they didn't belong, a couple of us came over to investigate. I was sitting at your desk, writing a note to you. I like the stationery you created for the jumble. When that Trina female scratched at the door until it opened, she wanted me to leave, insisted that you had asked her to find a couple of legal papers. She was offended that I didn't believe her.
Natasha seemed quite amused by that. So you bit her?
Oh, no. A bite can be so intimate, don't you think?
Considering some of the fantasies I'd had about Ilya, apparently I did think biting and intimacy could go together.
Besides, there are other ways to feed, Natasha added.
I was not going to think about that, because thinking about it made me feel like a walking juice bar. Raised voices, muffled by the closed door, were silenced by the sound of something large and metallic being dropped. I didn't know much about cars, even when they weren't being dropped, but I guessed it had sounded like that because the tires were now flat.
How many elders does it take to flip a car? I asked.
She gave me a puzzled smile.
Is that a human joke?
Not likely.
Maybe. While we're waiting for the police officer to ask his questions, why don't we review your accounts?
I figured she already knew I couldn't afford what she usually charged any more than I could afford my attorney. So I told her that was a nifty idea and began counting the hours until I could shove my first guests out the door. Chapter 49 Grimshaw Moonsday, Sumer 3 As far as Grimshaw was concerned, situations like this were exactly the reason why cops hated coming to places like Sproing or the Jumble, unless it was to help a stranded motorist or look for a missing child. The others in the wild country usually left you alone if you were helping a motorist, and they sometimes assisted in the search if they understood you were looking for a lost child. But when humans ran afoul of the Terra Indigene, nothing a cop could do except try to extract the humans without antagonizing the others. Well, he could shoot the humans. He was pretty sure the others wouldn't object to that. Explaining that to Captain Hargreaves or a board of inquiry might be tricky, assuming the bodies didn't just disappear before he had time to file his report. Which made him wonder why the body of Franklin Cartwright had been left in a place where it would be found and hadn't shown much sign of predation. Had the man been left as a warning about the penalties of trespassing in the jumble? Or was it a case of the smaller Terra Indigene not daring to grab anything from a kill made by an elder? Or most anything, he amended, remembering the call Vicky Devine had made about the eyeball that had started the initial inquiry. Herschel, a large gray-haired man who was older than the other two men, arrived at the main house and was as vocal as Vaughn and Darren about their treatment here and the damage to their vehicles. Grimshaw figured Herschel really had been in his cabin resting, or at least doing nothing that upset the others, since his UV was the only one that hadn't been damaged or vandalized.
"Let's go into the library and see if we can work this out," he said.
He didn't see the point of standing in the hall, and he wanted to get a look at Trina. She might need a doctor. Then again, she might need nothing more than a glass of juice and rest to make up for the blood donation she'd made as a penalty for picking a lock on a door that was clearly marked private. They just argued more loudly until the crash of something large and metallic.
"I'll go,"
Julian said. He hurried out, then hurried back in.
The overturned UV has been righted. The tires are flat, and there is some other damage, mostly dents and scratches.
Vaughn ran out to take a look. They heard a shocked sound, almost a scream, before he ran back in.
Someone is going to pay for that, he shouted.
You will, Ilya said. And for the tow truck, unless it is your intention to abandon the vehicle.
Vaughn's eyes were filled with fury and hatred, and Grimshaw wondered if the man had been a member of the Humans' First and Last Movement, before most of the humans who had joined the HFL were killed by the Elders and Elementals. Anyone left had survived by hiding their affiliation. But if Vaughn was one of the investors in this luxury resort nonsense, that would be sufficient reason to hate the Sanguinati's interference. Finally, Grimshaw had enough.
Anyone who wants me to make an official report will come into the library. It's a one-time offer. You blow me off now, and then want a report because your insurance company won't pay for repairs without one, then you'll have to pocket the expense.
This is outrageous, Herschel said. Who is your superior? I'm going to file a complaint.
Oh, he didn't want to do what he was about to do, because this was the first step in becoming entangled in the briars that were the village of Sproing. It was also the fastest way to make sure he wasn't hamstrung by orders that might come from someone other than Captain Hargreaves.
I'm currently the chief of police in Sproing, so if you want to file a complaint, you file it with me. I can tell you already where I'll put it.
Grimshaw walked into the library and waited. At first, the only individual to follow him was Ilya Sanguinati. Then, the five humans entered the room, grumbling and complaining. A minute later, Julian slipped into the library.
Definite signs that someone picked the lock on the office door. Not what I would call a professional job, but it was done by someone who has had some practice. You might want to take fingerprints and send them on to see if they match any unsolved burglaries at resorts around the Finger Lakes.
That started all of them yapping again, even Trina, who didn't look as wan as she had a minute ago. Which made sense, since he was certain that her fingerprints would be on the door. Grimshaw wanted to smack his friend, but all he said was,
Fox. Henhouse.
The guests didn't get the reference. Ilya Sanguinati laughed. The laughter shut everyone up.
We aren't staying here unless you deal with those creatures, Darren said.
Your guests, Ilya said. The Terra Indrajin live here. You can talk to Miss Devine about an early checkout. I believe I can convince her to forgive the rest of your bills, as long as the checks you sent for the deposits on the cabin and suites didn't bounce.
Miss Xavier, who runs the boarding house in Sproing, is in the kitchen,
Grimshaw said, looking pointedly at Julian.
You could inquire if she has sufficient rooms available. I'll do that.
Julian left the library.
Boarding house?
Pamela sounded offended that he would suggest such a thing.
I don't think so. Where is the nearest hotel that isn't a dump?
Bristol, Grimshaw replied.
Pamela sniffed in a way that said there was nothing suitable in Bristol. Julian returned.
As a favor to Miss Devine, Inike will rent them rooms for the rest of today. But they need to be out by 11 a.m. tomorrow, because, after that, all her rooms are booked through the rest of the month.
That's unacceptable, Vaughn said.
We may need to stay longer to settle legal issues.
Then you'll have to stay somewhere else, Julian replied.
Where?
Vaughn snapped. Grimshaw thought about the Mill Creek cabins, but realized that not only were those rented on an annual lease, they were owned by the Sanguinati at Silence Lodge. Not the kind of landlords these humans would want. Darren, Vaughn, and Herschel looked at one another. One by one, they nodded, as if casting a vote.
Fine, Darren said. We'll stay at the boarding house until we conclude our business. Until 11 a.m. tomorrow,
Grimshaw corrected.
He was sure getting him reassigned to some remote human village in the northeast was going to be a high priority for these men. He'd call Captain Hargreaves and give him a heads up, but they would be out of the boarding house before they could put anything in motion. He hoped that was true.
Ms. Xavier will be going back to her place in about half an hour, Julian said. She can fit two people and some luggage in her car. The rest of you will have to ride in the available UV. What are you going to do with the other two vehicles?
Grimshaw asked Vaughn and Darren.
We'll leave them here. For now, Vaughn replied.
As the humans filed out of the room, Ilya plucked the book out of Heidi's hands and gave her a fang-tipped smile.
This is Miss Devine's property.
Oh, but...
Heidi began.
We wouldn't want anyone to think you were trying to leave with something that wasn't yours.
Who would cut up stiff about a paperback?
Herschel snapped.
Do you know where you are the moment you walk out the door of this building?
Ilya asked, his focus still on Heidi.
The jumble?
She replied hesitantly. He shook his head slowly.
You're in the wild country, and there are a lot of beings between you and the nearest human place who would cut up stiff.
Heidi trembled. Tears filled her eyes. Her husband didn't put an arm around her, didn't do so much as take her hand. Dismissing the man, Grimshaw studied Ilya and realized the vampire hadn't been trying to frighten Heidi. He'd been trying to warn her.
Mikos, watch over me.
30 minutes later, Vicky Devine was still in her office with Natasha Sanguinati. Grimshaw figured that was Ilya's doing. Inike was at the front door, tapping one foot as she waited for Heidi and Herschel to get their things packed. Or repacked, since Conan insisted on looking inside their luggage to make sure they hadn't taken anything from the cabin. None of the others took pity on the humans who had to haul their luggage back to the cars unassisted. Neither did Julian. And Grimshaw decided he needed to keep his distance from these people, just in case Darren or Vaughn upset something that had bigger claws than Conan Beargard. It took more than 30 minutes, but the three couples finally headed for the boarding house, leaving him and Julian in the hall with Ilya Sanguinati, until Vicky and Natasha came out of the office.
They're gone?
Vicky asked.
They're gone,
Ilya replied.
Thanks for your help.
Grimshaw wasn't sure who was being thanked, but since the Sanguinati seemed to be waiting for him and Julian to leave, they walked to the cruiser and drove back to Sproing. He didn't say anything until they turned off the access road and were heading for the village.
You get any feeling about those people? I don't get feelings about people, Wayne,
Julian said.
I sense places. What's your sense of the jumble?
Julian looked out the passenger window. They were pulling into a space in front of the police station before he finally said,
It's no longer a safe place.
Chapter 50. Them. Moonsday, Sumer 3. The four men and their wives met in the Danes' room in the boarding house because Yorick couldn't even leave to go to the bathroom without that damn dog trying to dig a hole in his groin, looking for who knew what. Damn Vicky. He wasn't sure there was a way to pay her back for shooting off her mouth like that, but he'd sure like to try. Vaughn poured the wine, looking pissed and pleased in equal measure. He hadn't expected to be thrown out of the jumble. Hadn't expected to be thwarted when he sent Trina to look through the papers in the office and pull out anything that could support Vicky's claim to the jumble. But Vaughn said those things were a temporary setback in turning the jumble into a high-end money-making resort. Yorick wasn't so sure they would be able to turn the jumble into anything. Not anymore. The other men had done these kinds of deals before, buying a rundown property and fiddling with the deed in order to add a few more acres of land from neighboring plots. Then they built what they pleased with none of those creatures being the wiser.
but those deals, from start to finish, had been made with other humans, had been done quietly. And they had been done before the humans' first and last movement made that colossal blunder last year, that riled up the scary forms of others that usually didn't even notice humans. But this? People dying and Vicky making such a fuss, bringing in cops who had no allegiance to Vaughn or the rest of them, to say nothing of those freaking vampires. Too many people. Too many things were watching them now. When he'd first started flirting with Constance, he had bragged about owning a rustic resort right on the shores of one of the Finger Lakes. He'd known from family stories that there was no practical way to do anything with the place. But it had impressed Constance, who was Vaughn's cousin. And Vaughn was a top-tier member of the TCC and had barely noticed him before he started dating Constance and had sneered at his business deals, as if they were too insignificant to impress a true entrepreneur. Then the dating became a hot affair, and Vaughn and other top members of the TCC began commenting on the affair, drawing too much attention within their social circle, and Constance no longer found it amusing to be the other woman. She demanded that he divorce Vicky and marry her, but she had wanted to keep the house in Hubney and the car, and all his other assets. And he had to put up something that he could claim was of equal value, and then browbeat Vicky into taking it as her half of the assets. He'd known the buildings in the jumble were in poor condition, but signing over the place to her made him look generous, especially when he added the cash settlement that almost matched Franklin Cartwright's estimate of what it would cost to upgrade those buildings enough for people to use them. Days after the divorce was pushed through, he and Constance were married, and Vaughn introduced him to Darren and Herschel and said they were all interested in investing in this resort he owned to help him bring it up to quality standards. Yes, Constance had told her cousin all about the resort, had talked it up because he had talked it up to impress her. But she hadn't known he'd signed it over to Vicky, so that Constance could keep the house and expensive car, and all the other things she had claimed they just had to keep. Vaughn had been furious when he'd learned about the division of the assets because he had talked up the jumble and had Darren and Herschel salivating over the chance at running a posh lakeside resort. After seeing that side of Vaughn's temper, which wasn't half as unnerving as Herschel's cold sympathy about troublesome divorces, York had been afraid to tell the men about the wording of the original agreement, and that it wasn't laziness or lack of vision that had stopped any of his relatives from making money off the jumble. "Here's to the Tie Clip Club's next successful business venture," Vaughn said, raising his glass.
"We will make a success of it," Constance said.
"Where would the Clippers be without their women?" Herschel said, giving York a chilling smile.
The Tie Clip Club. People collected all kinds of rubbish, and in school there had been all kinds of clubs. Who would suspect that the movers and shakers in all kinds of businesses, and even in the police and government, formed their alliances by belonging to a club that collected tie clips? Who would suspect that the tie clip that had been specially designed for club members would have real significance when those young men left school and began working in their various fields? While they were in school, members who weren't society boys endured being laughed at for belonging to such a dorky club, and never forgot the names and faces of the ones who had laughed when it came to awarding job contracts or hamstringing someone's climb up the business or social ladder. Members helped members. Saying no was not an option. And that was the catch. When a member asked for help, the rest of the membership was expected to provide whatever assistance they could. It was one reason why the founding members hadn't stuck to their own social circle when they began recruiting a couple of generations ago. Rubbing elbows with young men who were attending the public university, the tech college, and the police academy hadn't felt right. But when those men became the owners of their own construction companies, or owned the garages where you could get your expensive luxury car fixed, or became high-ranking members of the police force, putting up with them while you attended the private college along with your real peers made sense. Just like marrying Vicky had made sense. She had been such a social nobody. It had been easy to dazzle her with the great future they would have together. And he had dangled that dream in front of her during the years when she'd worked to support them while he'd waited for his trust fund to kick in and dabbled with working whenever she balked at making a payment on his tailor's bill instead of paying the electric company to keep them from turning off the service. She wasn't the right wife for a man like him, but she'd been useful, and it had been so easy to convince her that his affairs were her fault because she wasn't enough for any man when it came to sex. A lot like Heidi, in fact. After he'd gotten Vicky off his back, York hadn't understood why Herschel hadn't dumped Heidi years ago. But that was before he realized that Herschel sometimes needed to tune up his partner a bit in order to really enjoy sex, and Heidi was enough of a doormat to take it. If he hadn't needed to divorce Vicky and marry Constance in order to remain in good standing with Vaughn and the rest of the tie clippers, would he and Vicky have reached the point where foreplay included the back of his hand to make things good? Not something he could try on Constance, of course, with her being Vaughn's cousin. If Vicky showed that attorney all the paperwork, he'll wonder about me presenting this document now, Yorick said. We'll swear we saw it with the rest of the paperwork when you were working out the terms of the settlement, Darren said. She destroyed her copy in order to retain her hold on property that was no longer hers. Her signature is on the document, same as yours, and it's notarized. First thing tomorrow morning, you'll go to the police station and insist that Officer Grimshaw, in his capacity as the chief of police, help you issue the eviction notice, Vaughn said with a nasty smile. Yeah, he liked that idea. They discussed going out to eat, not that there was anything remotely adequate in Sproing, but the rooms included breakfast and dinner in their price, and not eating at the boarding house didn't reduce the price of the rooms. Herschel had already checked. Pamela claimed a severe allergy to dogs, so at least that beast wasn't tormenting him while they ate dinner. Miss Xavier, Vaughn said, when Inike filled the coffee cups and set out plates of fruit, cheese, and chocolate at the end of the meal. If we decide to stay a bit longer tomorrow.
Checkout is 11 o'clock, Inike said. Other guests are coming in and we need to turn over the rooms, so I'm not offering extensions.
If we choose not to leave, what are you going to do? Vaughn persisted. Call the police.
She stared at Vaughn for so long, York began to squirm in his seat. Then she smiled.
No, I wouldn't call the police. There's someone else I call when I need to eliminate vermin.
Chapter 51. Vicky. Sunday, Sumer 4th. I had just finished washing the breakfast dishes when I heard a quick whoop of a police siren, a bloop of sound. There and gone so fast, I wasn't even sure I had heard it until Aggie ran into the kitchen.
Josie says Officer Grimshaw is here with those other humans, Aggie said. He flashed the lights and made the car howl, but just a little.
Since Aggie was naked and had more feathers than usual in her hair and framing her face, I deduced that she had been in her crow form when Josie gave the warning. Or maybe it was more accurate to say Josie was passing along Grimshaw's warning. Grimshaw didn't make idle warnings. Trembling, I hurried to the kitchen phone and called Ilya Sanguinati.
I'll be there, he said, when I stumbled out the reason for the call. Make sure the porch door and kitchen door are unlocked. Take your time answering the front door. Make some excuse.
Doing the dishes, had soapy hands. Wasn't sure I'd heard the bell with the water running. Since I'd seen Ilya flow through a screen door,
I figured unlocking the doors was for the convenience of someone or something else who would deal with a lock by ripping the door off its hinges. Wanting to save myself the expense of repairs, I made sure the back doors were unlocked before heading toward the front of the house. The doorbell rang again, immediately followed by someone pounding on the door.
"Damn it, Vicky!"
Yorick shouted.
"Open this door!"
What was he doing here?
"Miss Vicky?"
Had I stopped moving toward the door because I had stopped to respond to Aggie? Or had I frozen the moment I heard the anger in Yorick's voice? But he couldn't shove me against the wall and tell me how angry I had made him. Not with Grimshaw right there. Could he?
"Better if you're not here right now," I told Aggie. "Not undressed in human form."
She shifted to her crow form and flew up to the railing at the top of the stairs. Not in anyone's line of sight, but able to see and hear everything. In crow form, there wasn't much she could do against a human. Not much she could do against a grown man in her human form either. But I felt braver knowing Aggie was there as a witness. I opened the door and saw Yorick's fist coming toward my face before Grimshaw grabbed his wrist and stopped the movement.
"Sorry," I said. "I was washing dishes and didn't hear the doorbell."
"Miss Devine, we need to come in," Grimshaw said.
His police-issue sunglasses made it impossible to see his eyes, but I had the impression he was either really ticked off about being here or had a vicious case of indigestion and needed some seltzer. Either way, he wasn't asking permission to come in. He was telling me I didn't have a choice. I backed up and kept moving back as Yorick, Darren, Vaughn, and Herschel strode in, followed by their wives, and finally Grimshaw, who didn't fully shut the door.
"Miss Devine," Grimshaw said, coming to the front of the group, "it is my unpleasant task to serve you with this eviction notice, effective immediately."
"Eviction?"
I wanted to wiggle a finger in my ear like they do in movies to show that the person couldn't possibly have heard what they had heard. "How can you evict me? I'm the legal owner of this property."
"No, you're not," Yorick said, looking insufferably smug.
Grimshaw held out the folded paper.
"You have to take it."
Ilya Sanguinati strolled in from the back of the house, carrying a thin briefcase that must have been really expensive and top quality, judging by the envy in Yorick's and Darren's eyes when they spotted it. Even Vaughn looked uncomfortably impressed.
"I'll take it."
Ilya held out his hand. Grimshaw didn't hesitate to hand over the paper. I suppose giving it to my attorney was the same as giving it to me. I wasn't sure about that, but no one protested. Ilya took his time reading it. I was too busy struggling to avoid a meltdown to try to read over his shoulder. Or past his arm, since I wasn't tall enough to see over his shoulder, let alone read anything. He folded the eviction notice and handed it to me. When I started to open the paper, figuring I was supposed to read it now, he said in a voice as sharp as a slap,
"Don't bother."
If Yorick started in on me, I would buckle. I knew it, and Yorick knew it. His way of discussing anything had been to yell until I agreed with him.
"Mr. Dane, what makes you believe you are entitled to repossess this property?"
Ilya asked, his voice still sharp, but now also cold.
"This."
Yorick produced another document with a flourish. He tried to hand it to me, but Ilya reached in front of me and snapped it out of York's hand.
"It's signed by both of us, and it's notarized."
"It couldn't be,"
I protested.
"Victoria."
Ilya, using that tone of voice, was his way of issuing a warning. So I clenched my teeth to avoid trying to stick up for myself. Of course, if York and I went at it with all his friends taking his side, I'd probably end up in the hospital heavily sedated. So hoping that Ilya had a plan made more sense than having a breakdown.
This document seems to be more obscurely written than most human agreements. But stripping it down to its essence, it says that since the jumble had been in the possession of the Dane family for several generations, it came to you, Victoria, in the divorce settlement, with the provision that you could prove it to be a viable living, so that you wouldn't be a burden on the Dane family, or a homeless embarrassment. Ilya paused.
Ah, you had 6 months to do this, and if you hadn't made sufficient effort to have income coming from the property, it would revert back to the Dane family. Specifically, back to York Dane. I couldn't stand it. I had to say something. Even if I had seen that document, it isn't realistic to think this place could have been ready for paying guests in that amount of time. Not with all the work that had to be done.
Vicky.
York shook his head and tried to look sad. You can see your signature right there. You knew the timetable, and you didn't meet it.
I had people working on the main house and the first three cabins all winter, but some things couldn't be done until the spring. I wasn't ready for paying guests until mid-Mayus.
Conveniently, 2 weeks passed the deadline, Ilya murmured. Just 2 weeks? I hadn't worked out the dates in my head, and something about being off by so little time struck me as odd.
2 weeks, 2 days, 2 months, it doesn't matter.
York snapped at Ilya.
She didn't meet the terms of the agreement.
He turned to me.
You're evicted, effective immediately. Hand over the keys and get out.
No, Ilya said mildly. That's not how this is going to work. Miss Devine will leave immediately. I'll arrange to have all her personal possessions packed and out of here by the end of the day. You, however, cannot take possession of the property until the utilities are informed that as of 12:01 a.m. tomorrow, you will be the responsible party for payment. Also, before you take possession of the property, I need to know how you are going to reimburse Miss Devine for the capital improvements she made on the property.
Those are part of the property now, Vaughn said, narrowing his eyes.
Not quite, Ilya smiled, showing a hint of fang. The document says that if Miss Devine fails to develop the property in the agreed-upon amount of time, she will quit the property, leaving it in the same or better condition. My client chooses to return the property to Mr. Dane in the condition she found it, after his family's decades of neglect. He opened his briefcase and pulled out a single sheet of paper, which he handed to Yorick. Those are the capital improvements that were made to the main house and cabins. The total cost is listed at the end. You'll agree to reimburse Miss Devine for all the money she put into this property to make it habitable again. Or I can have crews here within the hour to remove the new septic system, dig up the new water pipes, and remove all the new pipes that were put into the house and the lakeside cabins, and remove the new circuit breaker box and any other electric work that was done here.
You can't do that!
A vein in York's temple began to throb as he turned to Grimshaw.
He can't do that!
I wouldn't bet on it, Grimshaw replied.
Fine, Vaughn said, looking like he would explode any second.
York will reimburse Vicky for the capital improvements. You'll have a cashier's check first thing tomorrow morning. Now I want her out of here.
The check will be drawn from a bank in the northeast that is still viable, Ilya said. And yes, Miss Devine will leave now. So will all of you, until the check is deposited, and the bank it was drawn on is verified. Mr. Dane is within his rights to evict Miss Devine, but he has no legal rights to the buildings. We'll meet at the bank in Sproing at 9 a.m. tomorrow. I'll hand over the keys at that time. Ilya turned to me. Please, fetch your purse and all of your keys. I thought he was helping me. Now I wasn't sure. When I looked at Grimshaw, he dipped his head in the tiniest nod, and I wondered if he knew something I didn't. Maybe Julian had said something? As I walked across the hall, I dug the office key out of my pocket. I had gotten into the habit of bringing my purse downstairs and leaving it in the big bottom drawer in the desk, so at least I would have that much. But what about my clothes, my bits of jewelry? They didn't cost much, but I felt like I was being stripped of everything for the second time, even if Ilya had said I would retain my personal possessions. I walked into the office and spotted Natasha Sanguinati, who raised a finger to her lips before I could say anything and alert everyone else to her presence. She approached the desk, making sure she was still out of sight.
"Don't worry," she whispered. "We'll take care of this."
I felt sick, and my hands shook as I took the purse out of the desk drawer. Natasha held out her hand.
"Ilya is giving you a ride. Give me your car keys. I'll make sure the vehicle gets to you."
The car keys were on their own ring, so I gave them to her and made sure I had my keys to the main house, as well as the set of master keys for all the cabins. I left the office, closing but not locking the door. I gave Ilya all the keys, including the loose office key. He put the master set in his briefcase, along with the loose office key.
"It's time to go," Ilya said, staring at Vaughn.
"We'll stay a bit longer to look around," Vaughn said.
"You've already looked around while you posed as guests."
"You need help with the vermin?"
Conan asked, as he and Cougar came into the hall from the direction of the kitchen. Cougar's lips peeled back in that disturbing smile.
"Heh, heh, heh, heh."
I was pretty sure the boys weren't going to be invited to the main house to watch Cop and Crime Night on TV.
"Let's go," Grimshaw said. "Don't get comfortable with your promotion, Chief,"
Vaughn said, as he walked out the front door. Everyone who could be seen walked out of the house and watched Ilya lock the front door. Yorick took a step toward me, but Ilya got between us and hustled me to the black luxury sedan. We were the first to leave, but when I looked back, I saw Conan and Cougar standing guard at the front door, and Grimshaw having words with Yorick and Darren. I also noticed an unfamiliar car parked next to the UV that belonged to Herschel and Heidi. Made sense. 8 people couldn't have come in one vehicle. But I wondered where they had rented a car.
"Could you drop me off at Inikay's?"
I asked. I wasn't sure I would make it that far before I needed to throw up. But I really wanted to talk to a friend, and I wasn't sure Ilya qualified right now.
"They still have rooms there until checkout time," he replied. "And all of Inike's rooms are booked for the week. More important, you would be more vulnerable to attack if you stayed at the boarding house."
"Yorick got what he wanted. There's no reason to attack me." Ilya sighed.
"You have so little faith in my skills as your attorney."
I guess Mount Victoria still had a little lava left.
"Your skills? I didn't have a chance to see the jumble before I had to accept the settlement or lose out on getting anything. But 6 months to clean up a place that hadn't been used for decades and bring in paying guests is ridiculous. I never signed that document. My signature was forged."
"I know."
The calm acknowledgement stunned me.
"You know?"
"Of course."
He turned toward me.
"Do you know how to kill a human, Victoria?"
"Could you kill a human?" "Anybody could kill another person. You could throw a rock in anger and have the bad luck of hitting just the right place to kill someone. You could push someone and have that person fall and break his neck. But that wasn't what Ilya meant." I shook my head. "No, I couldn't kill a human."
"I can," he said, quietly. "I have."
Suddenly,
I was very aware that I was in a car with two sanguinati who might have missed breakfast.
Those men are predators, Ilya continued quietly, looking away as he opened his briefcase. You are prey.
Black Eye needed the reminder. York and his pals certainly saw me that way, but Ilya, who nature shows would call an apex predator, saw me as prey too. The difference was my attorney seemed to be struggling to look past that sharp reality and help me. He removed a couple of sheets of paper from his briefcase. When we get to the Mill Creek Cabins, which is where you'll be staying for the time being, I need you to sign these revised rental agreements that indicate you rented one of the lakeside cabins to Aggie, Eddie, and Josie Crow.
I didn't rent to the three of them.
This new document says you did. If Aggie stays there alone, she'll be too vulnerable, and the new caretakers can limit the amount of time any friends can stay with her. But three of them listed on an official document? One can always keep watch on the cabin.
So we're going to forge a document?
Why not? They did. Ilya smiled. Besides, our document won't be forged since you and Aggie will sign this one just like you signed the original. The agreement is merely revised. Something Mr. Dane doesn't need to know. We turned off of Mill Creek Road, which was Main Street within the village limits, and drove down Mill Creek Lane. Like the access road to the jumble, it was gravel, not paved. But it looked well tended.
Why did you let them push me out?
I asked. Ilya said nothing until the car pulled up at the second-to-last cabin, and the driver got out and walked toward the water mill that generated the electricity for the jumble, as well as the cabins.
Do you recall Julian Farrell's reaction when you all played murder? Ilya asked.
Something upset him.
His ability as an intuit is to sense places. It's one of the things that had made him such an effective police officer, and also the thing that had saved his life. In that his ability makes him, and other intuits like him, an effective barometer for the health of a place.
But Julian is rubbish at playing the game, I protested.
But that night, the game was altered to represent the jumble, even to the point that some of the players were represented by teenies. It turns out that was enough of a difference for Julian to get a sense of place.
Ilya looked me in the eyes.
He called me that night. When I met with him in Officer Grimshaw, Julian told me that once the businessman predator arrived, you would die if I didn't get you away from the jumble.
I wanted to deny it, but Julian and Grimshaw had been acting weird since that night. I shook my head. York would push me until he got what he wanted. He knows exactly how to push my buttons. But he wouldn't kill me. I couldn't have married a man who would do that. Could I?
York isn't the dominant male. Vaughn is the leader of that pack. And he is a predator who could kill another human.
Ilya patted my hand.
But Vaughn is also a small predator who believes he is powerful and does not yet appreciate how many other predators are now watching him. He will appreciate it very soon. And while you and Grimshaw and Julian get this straightened out for silly, incompetent me, I'll just sit in a corner somewhere and do nothing because that's all I'm good at.
I'd meant it to sound humorous. Don't ask me how it could, but even to my ears it sounded bitter. Defeated.
Can you kill a human, Victoria?
Ilya asked. No.
Then let those who can deal with these predators.
That's your plan? Kill York and those other men?
Not if I can find a better way to solve the problem.
Oh, that did not sound good. I had a feeling that better meant a solution that was just as lethal, but not as bloody.
So while you're dealing with York, what am I supposed to do?
Ilya laughed softly.
First, you're going to sign this revised rental agreement. Then you're going to figure out how you want the furniture from your suite arranged in the cabin. And then you're going to decide which items you want stored in three of the other cabins that are available. We'll leave the one closest to the main road empty. The larger items that won't fit in the cabins will be stored in the outbuildings at Silence Lodge. My suite was basically an efficiency apartment within the main house. Everything I had there will fit in the one cabin. He just smiled and escorted me into the cabin that would be my new home. Chapter 52. Aggie. Sunday, Sumer 4th. As soon as she heard the front door lock and the cars start up and pull away, Aggie flew down to the hall and landed near the office doorway. She shifted to human form, pushed the door open, and watched the female Sanguinati quickly filling a box with file folders Miss Vicky kept in the cabinets.
"Those belong to Miss Vicky," Aggie said.
"Yes, they do." Natasha looked at Aggie, then looked past her. Aggie held out her arms like they were wings as she left the ground and landed several feet into the room when Cougar gave her what was meant to be a nudge.
"What are we going to do about this?"
Conan asked, coming in behind Cougar.
"Call in all the Terra Indigene living in the jumble who are willing to help," Natasha replied. "Fetch the packing boxes that are up in the attic. Fetch Miss Vicky's luggage as well. Trucks will be arriving soon, but we'll need the donkey carts as well to take the items from two of the lakeside cabins down to the water. The supply barge will take those things to Silence Lodge.
The Crow Guard will pack up Miss Vicky's personal things," Aggie said.
When Natasha gave her a questioning look, she added,
"We'll be careful, and we won't take any little treasures."
All the Crow Guard would help Miss Vicky, who was not only their friend, but the reader.
"And we'll pack up the books. Miss Vicky says they're a different kind of treasure, and she would want them in her new nest."
Natasha nodded.
"All right. But we need to move fast. Everything has to be done, and we all have to be gone before the humans return tomorrow morning."
"How much are we taking?" Conan asked.
Natasha pointed to a thick file folder on the desk.
"If Miss Vicky has a receipt for it, we're taking it."
Chapter 53. Grimshaw. Sunday, Sumer 4th. Grimshaw watched Officer Osgood enter the police station with a delivery box from Come and Get It.
"I heard you didn't eat breakfast this morning," Osgood said, as he opened the box and pulled out a thermos and a covered dish. "It's a bit early for lunch, but the meatloaf had just come out of the oven, so Helen made you a sandwich and coffee. There's also some sliced fruit in there."
Just the idea of having breakfast at the boarding house had burned a hole in his gut after York Dane had waved that eviction notice in his face. Not even having the decency to wait until he had gone to the police station and officially begun his workday. He'd walked out, saying they could meet him at the office. Since most of the residents in the jumble woke up with the sun, he didn't think Vicky Devine would sleep in. But he wasn't going to give Dane and his pals the satisfaction of rousing the woman out of her bed in order to kick her off her own property. He toyed with the idea of calling Ilya Sanguinati, and had come to the reluctant conclusion that that would be seen as taking sides and could get him called back to Bristol if Vaughn and his ilk complained to the right or wrong person. But he'd counted on there being enough of the others up and about to see the cars crawl up the access road, forced to follow him at the speed he'd set. He counted on the couple of seconds of lights and sirens to draw attention to their arrival. And they had drawn attention. The best kind of attention. He breathed easier when Ilya had strolled in from the kitchen, as if he'd already been at the jumble for an early morning meeting. He didn't know what was going to happen now. He just hoped he'd enjoy it more than he had carrying out the law this morning.
Grimshaw didn't touch the food. Not yet. One reason he had preferred to remain in the Highway Patrol Division was that you didn't have to trust anyone but yourself.
Sit down, officer.
Osgood sat in the visitor's chair in front of Grimshaw's desk.
Sir? Something has been bothering me, and if we're going to continue working together, I need an answer to a question.
Osgood looked puzzled, but not alarmed, and not too eager to be helpful.
What's the question? Why do you think Swin tapped you for this assignment?
He'd been trusting the baby cop because Osgood had survived the elder's attack on the rest of the team. Now he needed to know if that trust was earned. Osgood met his eyes and didn't flinch.
There were rumors at the academy about a special group, a club that could provide ways to enhance a career. When Detective Swin said he'd heard good things about me, that I had a good record at the academy, I thought this might be an audition of sorts for the club. But the drive up to Sproing was long enough to convince me I didn't want to be beholden to someone like him, and I'd already decided I wouldn't join the club if I was invited.
He hesitated. So either I was tapped for the assignment to find out if I should be considered for membership,
or,
Grimshaw prompted when Osgood hesitated again, or Detective Swin brought me along as the expendable member of his team.
That meshes with my thinking.
Grimshaw opened the thermos and poured a cup of coffee for himself, then gently wagged the thermos at Osgood in invitation, and felt the last whisper of suspicion quiet when Osgood fetched a coffee mug from his desk and held it out to be filled. Grimshaw almost offered to share the meatloaf sandwich. Then he took the first bite. Nope, not sharing. Best damn meatloaf he'd ever tasted. He finished the sandwich, set the fruit aside, and sipped his coffee. Osgood sat across from him, waiting.
Franklin Cartwright was working for York Dane. When Cartwright is found dead, Swin comes running up here to handle the investigation.
Grimshaw weighed what he knew and balanced it against what he could see coming even before he went over to let us read and talk to Julian, then to Osgood.
You sit there and just listen.
He called the Bristol police station and waited for Captain Hargreaves to come on the line.
Captain, it's Grimshaw. Could you call in another favor with the source who knows the ITF agent who has a direct line to the governor? I need a background check on some people and don't want to alert anyone in the Hubney police force in case a member of a certain club hears that I'm digging.
I especially need to know if any of the people I'm checking have had any combat training, even unofficially.
We may have a lethal situation here.
Chapter 54. Them. Wednesday. Sumer 5. York opened the passenger door, tired of listening to Vaughn lay on the car horn, and worried that the man might try to drive through the thick chain across the access road. Swin and Reynolds were mad enough about being stuck in that camper site because there was nowhere else to stay in Sproing, and Swin wasn't about to use up his personal fuel coupons to drive back and forth from Bristol, or, God's help them, Crystalton with all its freaks. If Vaughn wrecked Swin's car trying to prove some point, it would be hard to find another ride. They had tried to lean on the bank's former manager for the loan of his car or the use of his house, but the man had run off with his family to parts unknown, something the rest of the Clippers weren't going to forget when the idiot came back looking for another cushy job.
"I'll move the damn chain,"
he said, getting out of the car. The creep who had opened it the other morning had made it look easy, but the chain was heavier than he'd expected. He dragged it to one side of the gravel road and left it there. He didn't think Vaughn would leave him to make his own way up to the main house since he had the keys, but he didn't want any delays. They'd done it. The whole thing had played out just like Vaughn said it would. Well, except for Franklin Cartwright ending up dead. But York had a prime bit of real estate back in his possession. And once Vaughn and Herschel figured out how to get around the restrictions in the original agreement, they were all going to make a bundle of money, not just from creating a luxury resort for the discerning elite, but from the acres of timber waiting to be cut and sent to the sawmills as well. He hadn't expected to be required to reimburse Vicky for the capital improvements she'd made on the property. He'd figure he could mess with her head the way he used to do and intimidate her into fleeing, stripped of every asset he'd conceded in the divorce settlement. But that damned attorney had been right there, looking at the paperwork, handling things, not giving him a chance to talk to her alone. She wasn't even at the bank this morning. Ilya Sanguinati had met them, verified the bank York had used for the cashier's check, and deposited the check before handing over the keys. So that money was gone unless he could talk to Vicky and convince her she didn't deserve to keep all of it. But that damn blood-sucking attorney wouldn't tell him where she was staying, wouldn't even give him her mobile phone number. There couldn't be that many places where she could stay, since he'd deliberately not given her any time to make plans. Maybe one of the cabins down on Mill Creek? Swin had taken a look around there early in his investigation. Only one cabin was being used, but he hadn't been able to get close enough to find out who was living there, or so he claimed. He never did explain why he couldn't drive to the end of the lane to poke around that last cabin. Vaughn thought Swin and Reynolds were too spooked to be much good anymore, but for now they were better than nothing. When they reached the main house, York heard crows cawing, but didn't see any of them around the house. Something else nearby yipped or howled. He shivered, anxious to get inside, and put a stout door between himself and whatever was out there. Small shifters would be a nuisance, but something big had killed Franklin Cartwright and the detectives on Swin's team. He unlocked the door, and they all walked into the large hall. Big enough space for cocktails and nibbles and other kinds of informal gatherings. Would have to hire a cook. Maybe that girl who worked at the boarding house. He'd float that idea with Vaughn, Darren, and Herschel.
Son of a bitch,
Vaughn said, focusing York's attention on the house.
What happened to the curtains?
Trina said.
Where is all the furniture?
Constance demanded. York hurried into the office. The desk and an old carpet were still there, but nothing else. Not so much as a paperclip.
Son of a bitch!
Vaughn shouted, his voice coming from the back of the house. York flipped on the light switch in the office, then looked up when nothing happened. What the? Chapter 55. Vicky. Wednesday, Sumer 5th.
Tell me again,
Inike said, when we took a milk and cookie break from unpacking my things and arranging them around the cabin. The Terra Engine that Ilya signed to clear out the main house and cabins took everything that hadn't been in the jumble when I arrived. They even took the light bulbs. Inike's eyes gleamed behind her black-framed glasses. She looked like a child being told the best story ever.
That is so amazing!
I know. I couldn't believe it when they carted in the boxes of bulbs.
No, not that.
Inike waved a hand dismissively.
Your attorney is literally a bloodsucker. So I expected him to wring everything he could out of your idiot ex. What's amazing is that you kept the receipts for light bulbs to prove you bought them.
I blinked. That wasn't quite the reaction I'd expected. I thought I was supposed to keep the receipts for everything. The attorney who represented me during the divorce made a passing remark about me keeping receipts since I would be running a business, and I'd been so afraid of not keeping something that would have a serious impact on my depleted savings when I had to send in my tax forms that I had saved everything, all neatly labeled in file folders. Inike leaned forward.
You kept receipts for everything? Even the paper products?
Well, you're the one who told me I should do that because I would need to buy in bulk. And things like paper towels and toilet paper aren't cheap anymore.
The others took those too?
Even the partially used rolls of toilet paper?
I looked at the box marked paper and wondered if all the rolls of TP had been riddled by cougar's claws. If I had a receipt for it, they took it.